Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your Cognitive Rampage. You have to believe in the power of you. Uncomfortable is where the change is. Have to be willing to question the impossible, or you're planning for the inevitable. Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your Cognitive Rampage. On this podcast, I cover why we lie. I use the Jesse Smollett example to open up with, and, well, I cover a lot of the science, the research, the things that I could pull together, try to make it a quick, kind of easy, short read for myself so I could pull a lot of that research together. Big shout out to National Geographic, as well as John Hopkins University and many of the other authors, writers that were pulled together to collaborate this podcast to, well, try to explain a little bit about why we lie. Some of the background, a lot of research experiments that have been done trying to figure this out as well. And a lot of love to those researchers that have been studying this for a long time. I mentioned their names during that portion of the podcast. I also go off on a bit of a cognitive rampage, as I do if I start talking about mental health diagnosing, misdiagnosing, overdiagnosing, as related to the pill pushing that comes behind that. I cover pretty in detail what some of those issues really are with the diagnosing, as well as how that leads to other things. And I wrap up this podcast about athlete's depression, my next book I'm currently writing. I'm back on the writing schedule, getting this book out and down. Writing it from a little bit of a different perspective than I wrote my first two books. This one's a little more investigative and lining up some interviews, as you'll be hearing on the Cognitive Rampage podcast as 2019 goes on. So hope you enjoy this Cognitive Rampage about why we lie, athletes' depression, and issues with mental health diagnosing and pill pushing. And welcome to the Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you are living your Cognitive Rampage. Hope everybody's week is wrapping up beautifully. It is Friday. I do look forward to Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, all of them. We're still alive, right? So something we can certainly look forward to. As I said on the last podcast, the next podcast would be covering why we lie. And that's what I'm going to cover on this podcast. I put together some notes, some research, some articles, some other things, and kind of pulled it all together to try to make it a clean read for you, or at least something you can stand so I don't go on a tangent and go off like I typically do. So I tried to pull some of this stuff together for you as well in the wake of Jesse Smollett and his, ordeal. I'm sure a lot of you asked, like me, why the hell would somebody do that? Why would someone lie about something like that? And we have a lot of reasons, right, that immediately may come out to you. We may say, he just wanted attention, right? He's trying to curb it to, he was upset about how much he wasn't being paid. He has now came out and said he has a pill problem that, well, he hasn't treated. So I don't know. Could be a lot of those things. Check the sound there. Sounds working good on the back end. But why we lie, right? I mean, I think a lot of people like to state that I don't lie. I'm honest, right? That you've never lied about anything and everything's, well, honest with you. And I think, well, we have all lied a time or two or more in our lives about something. And sometimes maybe even when we didn't have to, right? We just may say something one day, right? That may happen. But Before I kind of walk into the notes and the things I've put together, I also will be ending this podcast with what I'm calling the preface to Athlete's Depression. I am entering the phase of the serious writing phase, rather than sketching the notes, pondering the outline or which direction I may take. It begins to sit down. You know, I tell everybody, you can write a book, especially if you've wanted to. I think a lot of people may think too much about how to write a book or what to do, when frankly, I tell people, look, just sit down, verbally diarrhea all over the page, and just all over your computer, whether you do it that way. I mean, if you want to write by hand, go for it, and get it all out. Just get it all out until there's nothing else to say. Don't worry about order or anything like that. Just get it out, and then when you're done getting it out, you know, somewhere between A and Z is your book. Then it becomes a process more or less of moving the pieces around and editing. You'll end up taking out more. You may add a little bit along the way, but that's how I suggest it, you know, suggest how to do it. There's a bunch of ways you can write a book. The one thing that's common with all of the methods of writing a book is you have to write. You have to actually type or write and sit down and do it. So a lot of people fear that. I don't know how to start it, right? I mean, just go. Just sit down. What I end up doing to start writing is I pick a day of the week, typically, and we'll say, this will be the day I write where I have no distractions. This is where I'm going to write. And I sit down and begin writing. Before I know it, the one day to write has turned into two, has turned into three. And before I know it, I'm writing almost every day in that zone. But that's me. You can find your way to do it. And yeah, I can encourage everybody to at least write. Go through that. Something you can check off at least once in your life. It's a cool thing to do, right? And there's always editors, okay? Because trust me, I am definitely someone that needs an editor or 10, okay? I was public school system in Orange County, Florida, which I'll go ahead and knock a little bit. So I went through the era of phonetically spelling, grammar, etc. So don't worry about that, right? You can find editors to edit that through you. And also, after you've written that A through Z thing, I want you to go back and read what you have. Maybe after you've even edited, pulled kind of something together, you think you might be getting close to what you got. Read the book as if you are your critic and make notes. Because I did that with The Cognitive Rampage, which is available on Amazon now and Barnes & Noble. As I went back and read and say, okay, if I was arguing myself, what would I say here, right? And then you can go back in and kind of add that argument, right? That's why I always talk about being able to argue two sides of any one topic. Makes you more competent, right? Instead of just one, God forbid we do that in our politics these days where people actually learn both sides of the issue and somewhere in the middle. But go back and read it as your critic. Go back and read it as your fan. And I mean you being a fan of yourself, what you like. Because then you'll find things where you may be writing a little overboard or too much. You'll be able to tone that back down. And then obviously hand that for someone else to read that may not know you. Right? And someone that does know you, get a bunch of different eyes on that thing as you can. But I encourage everyone to sit down and write. So I'll be getting to that at the end of this first topic that I'm going to walk through, which is why we lie. And well, frankly, if we had all the answers, maybe. So we lean a little bit towards science experiments. So what I did is I put a lot of research together. And again, I kind of weaved all this to where you'll hear stories coming from some of these writers of some research that I grabbed, articles that I grabbed. Also, some of my own ad libs in the middle, some stories along the way. So I'll do my best to make it not sound like I'm reading directly from it. But I figured with a topic as broad as and as wide as maybe why we lie and with a lot of interest in it, I didn't simply want to go off my own biases about why we do it and walk down through all the reasons why I believe. I'll just add those in along the way, right? And then I'll get to the athlete's depression stuff. And again, you know, things like the Jussie mullet thing. Mullet. it just... He set people back, I think, when he did that. I mean, the boy who cried wolf, essentially, to sum that up, right? I mean, next time somebody comes out about that, I think people may be more less apt to support someone like that, which is a terrible thing. If that happens to somebody, they need the support they can get. I think social media also, it does also show kind of a revealing look about how quick social media is to just jump on something without fact checking, right? Without really waiting for the story to unfold. You know, everyone wants to be the first one to break the story, to retweet the tweet that gets retweeted 1,000 times. And I think it kind of points out some of the issues that we have there on that side, on how much we want to just share something that's a lie, right? And I'm not going to get into fake news idea. You hear enough about that. But I think it points out something in our culture that, well, could be wrong with what's happening. You know, we're very quick to point out injustices as we see them, run with them without asking any questions, and then look back like, oh, Well, it was still bad, right? Even though it didn't happen. And so why we lie is where I'm going to start. The history of humankind is through with crafty and seasoned liars. Many are criminals who spin lies and weave deceptions to gain unjust rewards, just like the financier Bernie Madoff. I still think that's funny that in some odd way that one of the largest financial crimes ever was done by a guy with the name Madoff. He made off with it. I do think that's an odd thing. And also, before I keep going in this, there's a joke by Tom Segura that he does that is actually kind of, I don't know, part of it may be true about why we lie. He talks about, you know, the little kid is growing up, right, and trying to find that attention in some way. And, you know, the kid comes back with some news that he saw Uncle So-and-so, except Aunt, whoever it was, wasn't with him. It was some other girl or woman. And then the crowd around him, the parents or whatever, the family kind of, oh, what? What do you mean? Tell us what. And then gets a response. And the kid's like, oh, I got to get more of these. I got to get more of these stories, right? That's essentially maybe explaining why we gossip, why we like to be the trader of information or the one coming back to say at the water cooler what's happened, right? We get those responses. And although it's a joke, I think some of that is possibly true in what we do. So maybe that one joke by Tom Segura could sum up this whole thing, right? That we find the attention, we want to get more of that attention, and we try to find ways to get it. So back to Bernie Madoff, what he did for years, dumping investors out of billions of dollars until his Ponzi scheme was collapsed. Some are politicians who lie to come to power or cling to power, as Richard Nixon famously did when he denied any role in the Watergate scandal. Sometimes people lie to inflate their image, a motivation that might be best explained by, well, POTUS currently demonstratingly false assertion that his inaugural crowd was bigger than President Barack Obama's first one. People lie to cover up bad behavior, just as an American swimmer, Ryan, well, it's Loke. I write the names down. It's a joke. I also host some NASCAR shows, and people joke about how I can't pronounce the last names, but perhaps I can't. But Lockett, Loke, you know who it is. During the summer, the 2016 Summer Olympics, by claiming to have been robbed at gunpoint at a gas station when, in fact, he and his teammates drunk after a party had been confronted by armed security guards after damaging property. Very similar a little bit to Jussie's deal. And if you didn't know it, Jussie also wrote a check for that, by the way. Jussie wrote a check to the guys he asked to beat him up, which didn't think that went through all the way. Even academic science, a world largely inhabited by people devoted to the pursuit of truth, has been shown to contain a rogues gallery of deceivers, such as physicist John Hendrick, who purported breakthroughs in molecular semiconductor research proved to be fraudulent, right? I mean, a lot of scientists out there want to be the one to say, hey, I discovered this, this works, and they kind of hide this little portion of it, right? And perhaps maybe that happens a lot more than we know. But these liars earn notoriety because of how egregious, brazen, and damaging their falsehoods were. But their deceit doesn't make them much of an arbitration, as we might think. The lies that imposters, swindlers, and boasting politicians tell merely sit at the apex of the pyramid of untruths that have characterized human behavior for eons. Lying, it turns out, is something that most of us are, well, very good at. We lie with ease in ways big and small to strangers, coworkers, friends, and loved ones. Our capacity for dishonesty is a fundamental human behavior to us, as our need to trust others, which ironically makes us terrible at detecting lies. Being deceitful is woven into our very fabric, so much so that it would be truthful to say that to lie is human. The first documented motion of lying was first documented systematically by Bella DiPaolo, a social psychologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. 2 decades ago, DiPaolo and her colleagues asked 147 adults, the first research, I should say, asked 147 adults to jot down for a week every instance they tried to mislead someone. The researchers found that the subjects lied on an average of 1 or 2 times a day. Most of these untruths were innocuous, intended to hide one's inadequacies or protect the feelings of others. Some lies were excuses. One subject blamed the failure to take out the garbage on not knowing where it needed to go. Yet other lies, such as a claim of being a diplomat's son, were aimed at presenting a false image. While these were minor transgressions, a later study by DiPaolo and other colleagues involving a similar sample indicated that most people have, at some point, told one or more, quote, serious lies, hiding an affair from a spouse, for example, or making false claims on a college application or resume. That human beings should universally possess a talent for deceiving one another shouldn't surprise us. Researchers speculate that lying as a behavior arose not long after the emergence of language. The ability to manipulate others without using physical force likely conferred an advantage in the competition for resources and mates, akin to the evolution of deceptive strategies in the animal kingdom, such as camouflage. Quote, lying is so easy compared to other ways of gaining power, end quote. Notice Harvard professor Cicela Bock. She's one of the most prominent thinkers on the subject. Quote, it is much easier to lie in order to get somebody's money or wealth than to hit them over the head or rob a bank. As lying has come to be recognized as a deeply ingrained human trait, social science researchers and neuroscientists have sought to illuminate the nature and roots of the behavior. How and when do we learn to lie? What are the psychological and neurobiological underpinnings of dishonesty? Where do most of us draw the line? Researchers are learning that we're prone to believe some lies even when they are ambiguously contradicted by clear evidence. Perhaps the cognitive dissonance I talk about often on the podcast. These insights were suggested that our proclivity for deceiving others and other vulnerability to being deceived are especially consequential in the age of social media. Our ability as a society to separate truth from lies is under unprecedented threat. I'm going to end up posting a chart that goes with some of this as well. When you see the post on adamlowry.com, the author of the beginning of this goes on to tell a story. When I was in the third grade, one of my classmates brought a sheet of race car stickers to show off at school. These stickers were dazzling. I wanted them so badly that I stayed back during gym class and transferred the sheet out of the classmate's backpack into mine. When the students returned, my heart was racing. Panicking that I would be found out, I thought up a preemptive lie. I told the teacher that 2 teenagers had shown up on a motorbike, entered the classroom, rifled through backpacks, and left with the stickers. As you might expect, this fib collapsed, and gentlest probing, I reluctantly returned what I had pilfered. My naive lying got better, trust me, was matched by my gullibility in the 6th grade when a friend told me that his family owned a flying capsule that could transport us anywhere in the world. Preparing to travel on this craft, I asked my parents if I could pack a few meals for the journey. Even when my older brother snickered, I refused to disbelieve my friend's claim, and it was left to my friend's father to finally convince me that I had been duped. These lies that my friend and I told were nothing out of the ordinary for kids our age. Like learning to walk and talk, lying is something of a developmental milestone. While parents often find their children's lies troubling, for they signal the beginning of the loss of innocence, Kang Lee, a psychologist at the University of Toronto, sees the emerging of the behavior in toddlers as a reassuring sign that their cognitive growth is on track. So perhaps we should not condemn or yell at our children for lying, right? Hey, we have great cognitive growth. They're learning how to lie. They're being human, right? To study lying in children, Lee and his colleagues use a simple experiment. They ask kids to guess the identity of toys hidden from their view based on an audio clue. For the first few toys, the clue is obvious. A bark of the dog, a meow of the cat, and the children answer easily. Then the sound played as nothing to do with the toy. So you play Beethoven, but the toy's a car, Lee explains. The experimenter leaves the room on the pretext of taking a phone call, a lie for the sake of science, and asks the children not to peek at the toy. The returning experimenter asks the child for the answer, following up with the question, did you peek or not? Sounds like something perhaps was asked during Christmas. I remember hiding behind the rust color couch that we had in the 80s and waiting on Santa to show. And I hid behind, that rust colored couch on the brown shag carpet waiting for this fat dude to show up through the chimney. And, I fell asleep behind the rust colored couch. This is my story, by the way. And, was then shooed off to bed earlier. And something my mother always jokes about, I was always quite curious. The Easter Bunny, it was a lie they told us, right? I was always thrown off by it a little bit. And I asked my mother at a young age, exactly how big is this Easter Bunny? Because in my child mind, I pictured a 10-foot-tall bunny walking on two legs into my room at night was rather creepy. And some of my notes here want me to talk about, as a reminder before I continue, about the experiment, did you peek or not? We lie to our children from the beginning. We lie and tell them about a fat guy coming down the chimney. We lie about the Easter Bunny. We lie about the Tooth Fairy. We lie about numerous things to our children as they get older, only to one day realize that, your parents have been lying to you generally because some friend in class looks at you and laughs at you in some age. I don't know what age that is for some of you, where you learn it wasn't real, and you learn that your parents have lied to you. And I wonder what that does to the psyche of first grader, kindergartner, second grade, when you think your parents would never lie, and then you realize the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny, and Santa have all been a lie. Perhaps maybe that's when you realize it's okay. Do we question whether we continue to lie about that or not? I don't know. Let's keep reading the research and possibly we'll find out some effects of that. So back to the experiment, ran. Did you peek or not? Asked Lee to the children. Most children can't resist peeking. Lee and his researchers have found by monitoring by hidden cameras, the percentage of children who peek and then lie about it depends on their age. Among two-year-old transgressors, only 30% are untruthful. So the terrible twos aren't so terrible with just 30% lying. Among three-year-olds, half lie. 50% lie among three-year-olds. And by the age of 8, 80% claim they didn't peek, even though they did. So as you get older, we get worse, as possibly the innocence is leaving even further. It's a scary thing to really wonder, to be honest, like that. Kids also get better at lying as they get older. In guessing the toy that they secretly looked at, 3 or 4 year olds typically blurt out the right answer without realizing that this reveals their transgression and lying. At 7 or 8, kids learn to master lying by deliberately giving a wrong answer or trying to make their answer seem like a reasoned guess. How you guess the toy is a car when you hear Beethoven is beyond me, but it's kind of cute, right? When the 3 or 4 year olds go, it's a car, after hearing Beethoven, and they don't even realize it. It can be scary, but kind of cute at the same time. 5 and 6 year old kids fall in between. In one study, Lee used Barney the dinosaur as a toy. A 5-year-old girl who denied having looked at the toy, which was hidden under a cloth, told Lee that she wanted to feel it before guessing. So she put her hands underneath the cloth, closed her eyes, and says, ah, I know it's Barney. Lee recounts, I ask why. She says, because it feels purple, she said. What drives this increase in lying sophistication is the development of a child's ability to put him or herself in someone else's shoes. Perhaps, side note, this is the empath building in the cognitive functioning of the child, right? If, you know, empathy in itself, by obscure definition, is to be able to put yourself in the shoes of someone else to be empathetic toward that person, right? So the development of lying, or a sophistication of lying along the way, is, well, grown and improved by the child being able to grow their empathetic response by putting him or herself in someone else's shoes. Side note, back to the research. Known as theory of mind, this is the facility where we acquire for understanding the beliefs, intentions, and knowledge of others. Also fundamental to lying is the brain's executive function, the abilities required for planning, attention, and self-control. The two-year-olds who lied in Lee's experiments performed better on tests of theory of mind and executive function than those who didn't. Even at 16, kids who were proficient liars outperformed poor liars. On the other hand, kids on the autism spectrum, known to be delayed in developing a robust theory of mind, are not very good at lying. Perhaps we call this charisma, or the con artist, right? Remember, the con artist is short for the confident artist. And, well, the charisma, the confidence to be able to do that, the better you are at that, well, apparently the better you are at lying and other cognitive functions as well. Back to the story of an author who was writing a portion of this here. Tells a story. On a recent morning, I took an Uber to visit Dan Ariely, a psychologist at Duke University and one of the world's foremost experts on lying. The inside of the car, though neat, had a strong odor of sweaty socks, and the driver, though courteous, had trouble finding her way. When we finally got there, she asked me, smiling, if I would give her a 5-star rating. Sure, I replied. Later, I gave her 3 stars. My guilt by telling myself that it was better not to mislead thousands of Uber drivers or riders. So rather than lie to the Uber riders, I, well, just made up my mind that it was worth the lie to her. Ariely became fascinated with dishonesty about 15 years ago, looking through a magazine on a long-distance flight. He came across a mental aptitude test. He answered the first question and flipped to the key in the back to see if he got it right. He found himself taking a quick glance at the answer to the next question. I have done this. Have you done this? Have you taken those quizzes and flipped one way and then went back and flipped and said, oh, I didn't really see the answer to 2 and 3. Let me try to guess anyway, right? Continuing in this vein through the entire test, Ariely, not surprisingly, scored very well. When I finished, I thought I cheated myself, he says. Presumably, I wanted to know how smart I am, but I also wanted to prove I'm this smart to myself. The experience led Ariely to develop a lifelong interest in the study of lying and other forms of dishonesty. In experiments he and his colleagues have run on college campuses and elsewhere, volunteers are given a test with 20 simple math problems. They must solve as many as they can in 5 minutes and are paid based on how many they get right. They are told to drop the sheet into a shredder before reporting the number they solved correctly. But the sheets don't actually get shredded. A lot of volunteers lie, as it turns out. On average, volunteers report having solved 6 matrices, when in reality, it was more like 4. The results are similar across different cultures. Most of us lie, but only a little. The question Ariely finds interesting is not why so many lie, but rather why they don't lie more. Even when the amount of money offered for correct answers is raised significantly, the volunteers do not increase their level of cheating. Here we give people a chance to steal lots of money, and people cheat only a little bit. So some things stop us, most of us, from not lying all the way, Ariely says. The reason, according to him, is that we want to see ourselves as honest because we have, to some degree, internalized honesty as a value taught to us by society. Which is why, unless one is a sociopath, most of us place limits on how much we're willing to lie, how far most of us are willing to go. Ariely and others have shown it is determined by social norms arrived through unspoken consensus, like the tactic acceptability of taking a few pencils home from the office supply cabinet. Patrick Kornberg's staff and fellow judges in the Los Angeles County Superior Court believed he was an American hero. By his account, he had been awarded a Purple Heart in Vietnam. He had participated in covert operations for the Central Intelligence Agency as well. The judge boasted of the impressive educational background as well, an undergraduate degree in physics and a master's degree in psychology. None of it was true. When confronted, Patrick's defense was to blame a condition called pseudodialogia fantastia, a tendency to tell stories containing facts interwoven with fantasy. The argument didn't save him from being removed from the bench as a judge in 2001. You see, there appears to be no agreement among psychiatrists about the relationship between mental health and lying, even though people with certain psychiatric disorders seem to exhibit specific lying behaviors. Sociopathic individuals, those diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, tend to tell manipulative lies, while narcissists may tell falsehoods to boost their image. But again, no agreed upon research between psychiatrists and the relationship between mental health and lying. No research and no agreement has a concise reason for why or linking mental health and lying. Remember that, okay? But is there anything unique about the brains of individuals who lie more than others? In 2005, psychologist Yaling Yang and her colleagues compared the brain scans of three groups: 12 adults with a history of repeated lying, 16 who met the criteria for antisocial personality disorder but were not frequent liars, and 21 who were neither antisocial nor had a lying habit. The researchers found that the liars had at least 20% more neural fibers by volume in their prefrontal cortices, suggesting that habitual liars have greater connectivity with their brains. It's possible that predisposes them to lying because they can think up lies more readily than others, or it might be the result of just repeated lying. Practice makes perfect, right? Psychologist Norobito Abe and Kayito from the University of Green, combined with Joshua Green at Harvard University, scanned the brains of subjects using functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, and found that those who acted dishonestly showed a greater activation in the nucleus accumbens. All right, some brain activity for more that lie, right? A structure in the basal forebrain that plays a key role in the reward processing. The more excited your reward system gets at the possibility of getting money, even in a perfectly honest context, the more likely you are to cheat, explains Green. In other words, greed may increase one's predisposition to lying. One lie can lead to another, as evidenced by smooth, remorseless lying of a serial con man such as Bernie Madoff. An experiment by Tali Sharat, a neuroscientist at the University of College London and colleagues, showed how the brain becomes inured to the stress or emotional discomfort that happens when we lie, making it easier to tell the next fib. So if you tell one follows, and our brain actually gets easier, well, better at lying, and then makes it a little easier with less stress in doing so. If you've ever tried to talk to a little kid who you know has lied, or even a teenager if you know have lied, and you kind of corner them and you give them the, well, first degree, and next thing you know, they're just shaking, they're sweating, and they can't hide it whatsoever. And this is what this kind of shows. You get better at lying the more you do it. Imagine that. In the fMRI scans of the participants, the team focused on the amygdala, a region that is involved in processing emotions. The researchers found that the amygdala's response to lies got progressively weaker with each lie, even as the lie got bigger. Perhaps engaging in small acts of deception can lead to bigger acts of deception, she says. Much of the knowledge we use to navigate the world comes from what others have told us. Without the implicit trust that we place in human communication, we would be paralyzed as individuals and cease to have social relationships. We get so much from believing that there's relatively little harm when we occasionally get duped, says Tim Levine, a psychologist at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, who calls this idea the truth default theory. Being hardwired to be trusting makes us intrinsically gullible. If you say to someone, I'm a pilot, they are not sitting there thinking, maybe he's not a pilot. Why would he say he's a pilot? They don't think that way, says Frank Abagnale Jr., a security consultant whose cons a young man, including forging checks and impersonating an airline pilot, inspired by the 2002 movie Catch Me If You Can. A great movie, by the way. That was a true story, actually. It was a book that I had read a long time ago. This is why scams work, because when the phone rings and the caller ID says it's the Internal Revenue Service, people automatically believe it's the IRS. I hope you don't. I don't. And people have certainly caught on to that nowadays with those scams they're running. But many elderly don't realize that someone could manipulate the caller ID. Robert Feldman, a psychologist at the University of Massachusetts, calls that the liar's advantage. People are not expecting lies. People are not searching for lies, he said. And a lot of the time, people want to hear what they are hearing. We put up little resistance to the deceptions that please us and comfort us, but be it false praise or the promise of impossibly high investment returns. When we are fed falsehoods by people who have wealth, power, and status, they appear to be even easier to swallow, as evidenced by the media's credulous reporting of Loci's robbery claim, I could substitute Trump there, which unraveled shortly thereafter. We tend to believe it. If they're successful and they have everything, we tend to just go with it, it seems like. Researchers have shown that we are especially prone to accepting lies that affirm our worldview. Memes that claim Obama was not born in the United States, deny climate change, accuse the U.S. government of masterminding the terrorist attacks. So I'm going to stop there because, hey, the jury's out on some of those, all right? Not the first one for sure whatsoever. and spread other alternative facts, as a Trump advisor called his inaugural crowd claims, have thrived on the internet and social media because of this vulnerability. Side note, I think it's not just the vulnerability of being able to be deceptive, but also the idea of wanting to be one that spreads this news to say, hey, guess what I found? Just like the little kid that says, guess what I found out? Guess what they did? Guess what he did? And I think a mix of what they're talking about here, along with the idea of the brain stimulus that we get from simple likes and shares and things, also play into this very vulnerability they're talking about. Debunking them does not demolish their power because people assess the evidence presented to them through a framework of pre-existing beliefs and prejudices, says George Lakoff, a cognitive linguist at the University of California, Berkeley. If a fact comes in that doesn't fit your frame, you'll either not notice it or ignore it or ridicule it or be puzzled by it or attack it if it's threatening to your belief schemas, right? I talk a lot about the belief schemas on how, even on the last podcast, when I talked about why people judge you, they're looking at your actions. And if you're able to be happy making opposite choices of them, you're confronting their beliefs of what they believe life should be or they should do and go, wait, you can't be doing it properly because I haven't made those choices, right? So it's confronting those belief schemas in front, which is what we tend to do. If you're a party affiliate, which I am not a party affiliate, once you choose the right or the left, you may read something and immediately dismiss it, whether it supports or argues your beliefs. A recent study led by Brony Swear Thompson, a doctoral candidate in cognitive psychology at the University of Western Australia, documents the ineffectiveness of evidence-based information in refuting incorrect beliefs. In 2015, Swear Thompson and her colleagues presented about 2,000 adult Americans with one of two statements: vaccines cause autism, or Donald Trump said that vaccines cause autism. Trump has repeatedly suggested that there is a link despite for lack of scientific evidence. I don't know. I'm going to asterisk that one. I told you on the last podcast, if you go back and listen to Lauren Maul, she was on the podcast and I don't know enough yet. Okay. I know they can be good. They can be bad. I'm trapped in the middle. I'm a dummy. Not something I'm researching so much. I don't have kids to vaccinate. So I'm just using what was written in this research that they did. All right. I'm not supporting one or the other in any sense of what I'm saying here. Okay, just to preface that as you listen to this later. Not surprisingly, participants who were Trump supporters showed a decidedly stronger belief in the misinformation when it had Trump's name attached to it. Afterward, the participants were given a short explanation citing a large-scale study for why the vaccine autism links was false. Large studies, sure. Other studies show the same, just asterisks in that. Go back and listen to the podcast with Lauren Mall. If you're hearing that right now and you're like, no, or Adam, shut up. People need to be vaccinated. If you're jumping there right away, I just urge you. I'm confronting beliefs. You know, I'm open. I'm kind of like, holy, I don't know enough. But I always kind of say, I tend to say that that's a great place to start with anything in life. If you immediately respond with yes or immediately respond with no, this is a good place to start with, hey, let me get some research in, or and more than just finding research that will support your claim, right? The participants across the political spectrum now accept that the statements claiming that the link were untrue, but testing them again a week later showed that their belief in the misinformation had bounced back to nearly the same level. Take this for any conspiracy theory on any level, perhaps why you flat earthers believe that. I'm certainly not a flat earther, okay? So that's one conspiracy theory that I'm just telling you. No. Other studies have shown that evidence undermining lies may in fact strengthen the belief in the lie themselves. People are likely to think that familiar information is true. So anytime you retract it or you run the risk of making it more familiar, which makes the reaction actually less effective, ironically, over a long term, says Swire Thompson. I experienced this phenomenon. This is Swire. This is an author, a second author of research talking about Swire Thompson's research. I experienced this phenomenon firsthand not long after I spoke to Swire Thompson. When a friend sent me a link to an article raising the 10 most corrupt political parties in the world, I promptly posted it to WhatsApp group and about 100 high school friends from India. The reason for my enthusiasm was that the fourth spot in the ranking was held by India's Congress Party, which in recent decades has been implicated in numerous corruption scandals. I shared with glee because I am not a fan of the party. But shortly after sharing the article, I discovered that the ranking, which included parties from Russia, Pakistan, China, and Uganda, wasn't based on any metrics. It had been done by a site called BBC Newspoint, which sounded like a credible source, but I found that it had no connection to the British Broadcasting Corporation. I posted an apology to the group, noting that the article was in all likelihood fake news. That did not stop others from reposting the article to the group several times over the next day. I realized that the correction I had posted had not had any effect. Many of my friends, because they shared my hatred toward the Indians Congress Party, were convinced that the ranking was true, and every time they shared it, they were unwittingly or perhaps knowingly nudging it toward legitimacy, countering it with the fact it would be in vain. What then might be the best way to impede the fleet-footed advance of untruth into our collective lives? This answer isn't clear. Technology has opened up a new frontier for deceit, adding a 21st century twist to the old adage age conflict between our lying and trusting ourselves. What do you do? Trying to shed a little light with some research that was pulled together. Yeah, flat earth, no. All right. So again, some of those were research and studies I was pulling together and why people do it, right? It seems to be that the smartest that tend to lie better and the higher functioning people and less quotes here functioning as the article referred to it as autistic, not lying, right? So you can trust someone with autism, I guess is what it's saying. They're not going to lie to you. And maybe the higher functioning people. I mean, we do know that it is the charismatic, outspoken, extroverted people, men and women alike, that tend to run companies, that tend to run countries or be elected to certain higher positions of power. I mean, good luck trying to be a politician and not lie once in your life, right? That's crazy research, though, when I pulled up that we tend to lie at least once to twice a day. But here's what I thought. How many people were lying during the research of how many times they had lied through their journal, right? So if we tend to back down our lies anyway, because we want to believe ourselves to be trusting, perhaps maybe it's double, right? Perhaps maybe we're really lying 3 to 4 to 5 times a day, really in what we're doing. It's interesting. And like I said, too, I also found it interesting that there's no agreement among psychiatrists in mental health and linking lying to mental health outside of the diagnoses of antisocial or sociopathic disorders such as narcissism or the other. No link, or at least an agreement of a link between someone that's lying a lot or how they lie. There's levels of lies, right? The white lie or the more serious lies of something. It is an interesting topic that I'll over probably the 2019 do a little bit more research on and bring up a few more times. But I want to just throw some research that was out there that you could put together on your own to kind of say, hey, this is what we found in this research. This is what they found here, etc. So I'll let you kind of be the decider of why we lie. I'm sure you have your reasons already. Already 42 minutes into the podcast. I try to keep these as short as I can, y'all. Definitely don't want to sip the coffee into the microphone. I hate that sound. So next topic, my new book, Athlete's Depression. It is coming. I am working on it. I have been mentally kind of compiling how I'm going to approach this book. If I have to be a critic of my recent book, The Cognitive Rampage, if I have to be a critic of that book, is I wrote that book too clinically. It was written, I was a practitioner at the time. I'm no longer a mental health counselor, but I was at the time, and I was immersed in all kinds of research and large words that some may call jargon, etc. They have man speak and other ways to describe what I was doing. But in the world that I was in at the time, it fit. So if I could probably go back and do anything different from The Cognitive Rampage, it would be to tone down the clinical jargon that I use to describe things. So I didn't so much make it a human interest story. I didn't tell stories. I told a few stories in there about some clients that I had had, quotes, Mary being one of those clients that I had, as well as some other stories. I talked about my own life in the beginning. But if you actually read the book, The Cognitive Rampage, the very first chapter, The Human Behind the Rampage, I tell a very brief story of mine, my story, kind of keep it brief. And if you watch how that story progresses in chapter one, what I was showing people is I applied everything beyond what they would read next. So as you went in to read chapters two through the rest to the end, how and what I tell you to apply, what to try, and the science of which that comes from, the cognitive, behavioral, environmental, biological, and the neurosciences. So I try to pull all those together and give somebody a way to apply that to yourself, right? That's what it essentially is. It was based on a theory I put together called transrational structure behavior theory, right? Being able to transition to a rational state of thinking and using structured behavior together to change your life while also working on the environmental influences in your life, including biology, other people, people, places, things, in summary. So what I essentially did is in the beginning just said, this is what happened in my life. This is what I did very subtly and, well, had a new life. And then as you go on to read, that's essentially what I was telling you. But in a critic to my own book, that is what I wish I could probably take back, is not writing it so clinically bound. But as the artist, you know, we're always judging our own work. Always is irrational, right? One day we die and we can't judge it anymore. So the approach I'm going to take with this book, Athlete's Depression, is going to be different. Now, I will toot my own horn here for a minute and say I am the theorist behind Athlete's Depression diagnosis. I am the theorist behind that. It's just, I remember talking about it years ago when I first entered in the master's program to one of my mentors, Leo D'Annibal, who is still a mentor in my life, I mention often in The Cognitive Rampage. That I wanted to work with athletes because I believed athletes had something different going on. Being an ex-athlete myself, going through the destructive phase when my sports days were over, and well, I felt kind of an affinity there and was like, man, it's different. There's something different. And the more I learned about what depression was by itself and how that's diagnosed clinically, I saw some separation, a lot of separation, actually. And frankly, I wanted to treat just athletes. My main focus was to treat just athletes when I was coming out. That's where I wanted to focus. And so I'd mentioned this thing, and I continue to boast about it for a while. Like, hey, man, athlete's depression is a real thing. It is not the same thing as regular depression. And the more I got into it, the more I clearly see that. But I'm not going to write this book, Athlete's Depression, with the scientific jargon that I used in the Cognitive Rampage, as I want to make this more of a human interest piece and more of an investigative piece. Rather than trying to prove that it's something or prove it's nothing, I'm going into this book writing in our language, just our common vocabulary, trying to leave the jargon out that I have so been shoved in my face, in my mind, with all the reading and studying I've done over the years. So the idea is to write this in normal speak, if you will, in an investigative manner, to kind of see what we can find. I am beginning to line up people that I'm going to interview, athletes I'm going to interview, men and women alike, in various sports, because I don't just want to include contact sports, because this book is not going to be about concussion and CTE. Well, there's more research coming out on CTE, what concussions do, et cetera, ton out there, and how that can affect one's personality. But there is almost little to no real research. We know it can affect your personality, right? A hit to the head as small as bumping the corner of the cabinets in the kitchen to a car accident to playing football for years can have similar effects to our brain functioning, which then affects how we act, right? Our emotions, our behavior, personality, et cetera. But there's still so much more to come out. I mean, technically, we can't even identify CTE until one is dead and there's a brain autopsy. Although there's I think it's an LT1 protein. There's an article came out not long ago. There's some protein that they may be able to test for that kind of alludes to it in a way to be able to see who may be a candidate for something like CTE. But so I'm avoiding the concussion part in athlete's depression only because the lack of research I know that, well, isn't there. I know what's not out there, what we can research. So I'm sticking to the athlete's depression itself, okay? So, and I'm going to investigate it. I want to interview tennis players, which is, it's contact. You get hit with the ball. It's pretty rough. You can fall. That can be bad. From tennis to volleyball to golf, which is a non-contact sport, to mixed martial arts to football, and spread that out. So there's a few people already okay, ready to do these interviews. So as the Cognitive Rampage podcast goes on, what you're going to be seeing a lot on this podcast is me talking to athletes specifically. That's what you're going to see, okay? And look, if there's an athlete that you know that has experienced something like this and they just can't seem to, you know, find out or know what's going wrong or what it could do or be with them, tell them to reach out to me, whether it's professional athletes, college athletes, even lower fields. You don't have to have played collegiately, even just high school. A co-author that was going to co-author this book with me, Nick, haven't talked to him in a little while. He ran a small survey up at his college. We found some interesting things in that survey, almost that it didn't matter how long you played. It mattered more kind of when you started to play. And I was, well, happily surprised to see in that survey, it began to matter when you started to play because that kind of fits into it. So, although this preface that's been written is not the preface that will be in the book, it's something that I had written down about it for a while, is going to unfortunately be full of some of this jargon at the time, to which is not how I'm going to write this next book. But I kind of wanted to give a synopsis on, you know, where this is coming from, where this goes, and kind of the differences of simple depression, if you will, even if it's, a deeper depressive, more severe depressive state, between athlete's depression and this one, okay? So I'm going to just pull that out here and read that. So I begin the full real writing process on Monday when I dive into it. So this book will be coming soon. But again, I'm certainly the theorist and I hate to say founder because I do argue that mental health diagnoses are theoretical. Okay, I can't give you an x-ray or a blood test and tell you, hey, you have this diagnosis. And so many people are misled by that with mental health diagnosis. They go, hey, this person who's a doctor in quotes tells you, hey, you have depression, you know, take a pill here, you must have anxiety, you must have A, B, C. You pick the diagnosis because it meets some sort of criterion, right? You match 7 out of the 10 criterion, but you have to understand that all mental health diagnoses are theoretical. They are theoretical, and they're patient self-report. So the patient is reporting the symptoms. Again, you can't be x-rayed or have blood tests. There are no brain scans that are going to tell you you're depressed. And the link between the lack of serotonin and dopamine in your brain that you may be saying to yourself now, oh, depression's a lack of serotonin and dopamine, bullshit. Check the research. There's barely any research. There's theories that think this may be it, hence the serotonin uptake inhibitors with SSRIs, right? Now, I don't want to knock pills per se, okay, but you know, we use them way too much, way too fast, and they help people. Don't get me twisted. I certainly know they help some people along the way. And so just my point here is that mental health diagnoses are theoretical. They are theories, hence calling myself the theorist behind athlete's depression diagnosis. And look, I struggled. The reason I've taken so long to write this book is onefold. Because I have been I don't want to call myself anti-diagnosis, right? Because as a practitioner, the diagnosis really is to help the practitioner treat the client or patient. That's what it's really for. And to, if you will, give answers to the possibilities of why. The reason I didn't like that, I always thought the patient or client didn't need to know what the diagnosis was, even though, you know, okay, I have this. This is what I'm dealing with. The problem with that is the patient or client then downloads that as being who they are, and I am now depressed. I am anxious. I do have post-traumatic stress disorder. They become the diagnosis, right? I'm an addict, for one, in quotes, right? They become the diagnosis. And that is something that I thought was not good. This was maladaptive, in my opinion, because they're still going to experience the symptoms to which they're describing to you as a practitioner. But then if I give them the label of depressive, give them the label of anxious or traumatic affected, then this person begins to download this as something that they are affected by or who they are. All right. So the toil that I've experienced and went over and why I've held back from writing this book so much is that very reason, is I argued against diagnosis being used so frivolously and quickly thrown out. Hell, I went as far as saying that if you're a general practitioner doctor and you diagnose somebody with depression after talking to them for 10 or less minutes, that you should be arrested. Because you should not be diagnosing. The same if you're a teacher. If you are a teacher and you are diagnosing children in your classroom with ADD, ADHD, you should be fired. You should be fired immediately. I don't care what you think you've researched on Google, what you think you've seen, what you've observed, or anything like that. Unless you have a degree, a licensed practitioner, have been a licensed social worker, a licensed mental health counselor, a psychiatrist, if you've been there and you're a teacher, okay, but you're still biased. It's your student. You should not be diagnosing your children. And God forbid if a teacher, if you ever walk up to a child or a teenager in your class and you tell them that you believe that they may be ADHD or ADD, or you reach out to the parents and you tell them that their child may be experiencing this, you should be fired and ashamed of yourself, because what you're doing is allowing that child to then download this idea that they may be hyperactive or have an attention deficit disorder, which does a number on that child's psyche, not to mention scares the bejesus out of the parents when you do that, and you're not even able to diagnose. It's not your field, okay? So if you're a teacher and you do that, please stop it now. You are being negative. You are negatively affecting that child if you're speaking to that child or teenager and, well, saying you might have this disorder. So that is a terrible thing. And a general practitioner too, with no psychology courses, you don't study psychology. And plus, a real diagnosis is made over a 72-hour period. and it's done with a biopsychosocial workup. When you see a general practitioner, they are not doing a biopsychosocial workup. They are talking to you for 10 minutes or less based on your reports of what is, and then they offer you a pill that may make you want to hang yourself. This is why I say you should lose your license, or at least be put on some sort of suspension, because if I did surgery on somebody because I watched a YouTube video and I killed that person in that surgery, I would go to jail because I am not a surgeon. So if you are a general practitioner and you are delving out diagnoses left and right, calling people depressed and anxious, and you're offering them benzodiazepines, Xanaxes, or Klonopins, or you're throwing out Zoloft to them like it's M&Ms, you should lose your license. And I'm still saying that, because you should not be diagnosing that person. We should not be seeing our general practitioner for diagnoses such as depression and anxiety. This is what psychiatrists and psychologists are for. And also keep in mind, psychiatrists' job is to delve out and find a chemical or a pill that works with you. And as Maslow says, if you are a hammer, everything is a nail, right? There are psychologists that practice that are a lot less apt to dole out pills, all right? I'm going on a tangent here. I know this is a cognitive rampage, but I'm saying this, all right? So be wary is what I'm saying. Just because your doctor in a white coat at your general practitioner's office or even a specialist's office talks to you for 10 or less minutes and says you might have depression here, or, well, it sounds like you're dealing with depression. Remember, no blood test, no x-ray, no brain scan. No one can prove that you have that. And then when they tell you that, you tend to download it because they are wearing a white coat and, well, they wouldn't lie to you, would they? Prefacing the first part of this podcast about why people lie. Not to mention there's money and things at stake for many of these doctors to push those pills. They are becoming pushers of those pills, and that's what they are. All right. If I was pushing pills like that, I'd be doing 10 to 15 somewhere in some federal prison. If I was pushing pills like they were, and some do need to be arrested. I'm just putting that out there. And don't get me twisted. There are great doctors out there, too. Don't get me twisted. There are great practitioners out there that do it right, and there are pills that have helped people. Don't get me twisted, okay? I'm talking about the other side of it. A lot of times antidepressants do help. They help people. So I'm not knocking that. I'm just pointing out the other things here, okay? So moving on. As you could see, my reluctancy and the toil of writing the book Athlete's Depression comes from just this. When I feel this way, or think I should say this way, about diagnoses, why would I want to add another diagnosis? Why would I want to? Because I'm now of the belief that athlete's depression should be added as a diagnosis in the DSM-5 or the DSM-6 whenever they write the next one in 40 years. I do. I think it should be added to it. Now, my point is if you have that many diagnoses already, and the diagnosis, they help the practitioner, and a lot of times they help the patient too, as going, hey, I got an answer. I know what I'm dealing with. I know what I'm attacking. I know what's affecting me. It's not as a person. So allow me to argue the other side of that coin as well. The diagnosis allows the practitioner to set a treatment plan, to set treatment goals. You as the client or patient are able to say, okay, how do I deal with depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder? You can go find paths and avenues that can help you. So there is a flip side to that coin of diagnoses as well, because it helps you determine what you're being affected by, possibly, in quotes. Remember, it's theoretical. What you believe a lot of times is what we download as being our reality. So there are good and bad to both sides of this, okay? And hey, there are general practitioners that have diagnosed somebody with possible depression, given them the right antidepressant, and have titrated them off over time and have done it correctly. Yes, this happens too. So don't get me twisted. I know this happens, all right? I tend to argue both sides is what I try to do. So the more I sat on it, the more I thought about athletes that are going, what is happening to me? Why didn't the antidepressant help me? Why, after seeing a therapist for 5 years, have I not changed? Because these are the stories that I'm going to tell in the book. These are the athletes I'm going to share and write about, because it's different. The reason it didn't help is because it's different. Athlete's depression, its etiology, or how it manifests, how it becomes athlete's depression, is different than how regular depression, and I don't want to say regular, but your common diagnosis of depression manifests into somebody. And this is why so many athletes you see more and more are being outspoken about what their experience is during and after sports and what that's like. And many kids too, kids and teenagers that are experiencing that in high school and younger when things don't go as planned or even when they go great. Okay. I'm working with the NFL alumni now to pull some of those people to talk about. But so after a while, I just had to say, you know what, I'm going to write this book because there are some athletes out there that I know that have, well, been misdiagnosed, as you'll hear when I read this to you, that becomes the real problem. The misdiagnosis, the wrong treatment plan. Mind you, misdiagnoses in mental health is the number one lawsuit in all mental health. Whether you're a psychiatrist, psychologist, mental health counselor, clinical social worker, the number one reason for suing is misdiagnosis. So misdiagnosis is a scary issue. If somebody says, hey, you have this, but it really might be this, go back to one of my very first podcasts. You'll have to go to YouTube to watch it. The late, great, rest in peace, Dr. Brodsky, Dr. Louis Brodsky, who passed away about a year or so ago. I had the pleasure of interviewing him, and he is considered one of the foremost experts on bipolar. And go to the YouTube on Cognitive Rampage, scroll all the way down. It's literally one of the first interviews I had done. And a thing he points out, which is pretty scary to me, as you'll hear in that podcast, I'm like, oh my God, is if you give someone who's really bipolar an antidepressant, you get the God factor, right? Or the, oh my God, I've been healed factor. Here's what happens. If you give someone who has bipolar, actually as a bipolar diagnosis, and you give them an antidepressant, within 2 to 3 days, they're going to have a feeling of, oh my God, I'm healed. Everything is great. It's amazing. This is so amazing. Oh my God, my life is perfect. Thank you, doc. This is, you have found the right pill. This has worked for me. Then after day three, going into day four, serious crash and a flip to a serious manic phase. Side note, the most dangerous mental health diagnosis is a bipolar person in a manic phase. Okay, that is the most dangerous diagnosis. Look up mania and manic. It is the other side of serious depression to bipolar, right? It's not just happy and sad. That is not bipolar. It's mania mixed with some serious depression. So then all of a sudden you get serious mania that pops out of this person, and then they tend to cycle faster. They will rapid cycle is what it's called, rapidly cycling. Usually it's 2 weeks to 6 months when someone with bipolar will cycle. They'll go through 2 weeks of major depressive, 2 weeks of mania, and or spread out over 2 weeks or 6 months. But when you give somebody that is actually bipolar an antidepressant, Katie bar the door, as my grandmother would tell me, a southern slang down here, that person is going to rapid cycle even faster and be in a dangerous state of mania because it's poorly diagnosed. This, again, being another issue with general practitioners and other mental health practitioners so quickly giving out the diagnosis of depression and then suggesting antidepressants. Because there's more than just suicide and other things. This affects your hormones, your brain functioning. It really does a number on you biologically and neurologically, and especially if you're actually bipolar, okay? So these misdiagnoses become issues with athletes. It usually comes in phases. I'm not going to tell you too much that's about in the book, but how the misdiagnosis end up being an issue over time, all right? So to close out the podcast, let me read this to you as a synopsis, if you will. It will not be the preface to the book. It may, but... Let's see. What is athlete's depression? I experienced athlete's depression, or AD, for nearly a decade. I believe this should be a diagnosis within the Diagnostic Statistic Manual of the Mental Health Disorders, the DSM. AD hosts a different etiology as compared to its main misdiagnosis and most currently related major depressive disorder, ADHD, bipolar, and even identity dissociative disorder. These are the most popular misdiagnoses related to athlete's depression. In short, being raised as a high-performance athlete from childhood and playing only as far as high school or even collegiately, especially professionally, creates a 50 to 75% increase in the probability the athlete will experience, keyword here, severe mental health issues. The manifestation of athlete's depression contains a similar and unfortunate common etiology that leads to the popular misdiagnoses. Childhood athlete to adult athlete creates the individual to determine personal value directly by performance and even more enhanced than the typical child upbringing. A mental manifestation of direct sport programming meant to develop a resistive consciousness and one who is less likely to ask for help, parentheses, this is also beneficial. This naturally creates a cognitive dissonance toward any possibility of, quote, perceived weakness, end quote. In this sense, I am categorizing the existing social stigma surrounding mental health, meaning most athletes do not seek mental health help and choose to fight it on their own. Combined with the lengthy exposure to hypervigilant environments and situations being linked to highly rewarding states, this begins the conditioning of the body and the mind to need, continue to seek, and in many cases, cause the individual to consciously create hypervigilant environments and situations to return the body and mind to these rewarding states. Many times, this manifests in very high-risk situations, people, and behavior. The bigger the risk, the better. A cycle begins to emerge. The hardworking, non-fearing, non-quotes, weak athlete fights for varying lengths of time and wins, end quotes. It may even appear as if they are overworking or working perpetually or appear manic. Eventually, the individual athlete will lose, end quotes, for various reasons. A lengthy explanation I'll get into in the book, but generally based on cyclic emotional choices, behaviors, and self-created environments linked to biological and neurological rewards and formations. This sets in a I lost, quotes, mindset that can last for weeks, months, or even years. Due to value of self being trained to be measured by performance and performance only, behavioral, cognitively, and even socially, depression and severe self-judgment begins and can last for periods of time. The vigilance to which the individual fights the depression many times begins with the first misdiagnosis of ADHD or ADD. This, over time, combines with severe depressive episodes and other symptomatic issues begin to emerge, addiction, violence, and intense anger. Feelings and thoughts as far as self-harm can begin to emerge. At first, second, or even third assessment, over time, the criterion appears as if the depression, ADHD, or even bipolar diagnosis is present. These are the other popular misdiagnoses over time to which I refer. In reality, the athlete is, has been, and will continue to cycle this way due to athlete's depression, not the above-mentioned diagnosis. Athlete's social development is another major factor. Their social acceptance, placement, hierarchy, and identity is defined by the sport or position they play and how they perform at this sport equals the social acceptance levels. An athlete's development life stages are more heavily influenced than a non-athlete's social environment. The manifestation and etiology of athlete's depression has gone undetected and has incorrectly caused misdiagnosing to spin athletes and especially ex-athletes' lives seemingly out of control, leaving the individual with thoughts and feelings their mental health struggles are different than any therapist and especially any partner or family member can understand. The athletes are left on the killing fields alone and depressed. That's what I want to read up. That's kind of part. I have some other notes that go with it. And I'm just pointing out that if you imagine the 6-year-old, the 8-year-old, the 10-year-old, the 12-year-old, the 16-year-old, et cetera, on up, the rewards are so stimulating. Winning the game, catching the pass, scoring the goal, these making the hole in one, these rewards are like a massive dose of drugs. It's what it's like. That reward system is intrigued. It is hit, if you will, right? And the more you tap into that, the more you do it. On the other end, losing at those games or failing or performing poorly, what that athlete feels, well, is that much worse, right? The social status is influenced so heavily. Because you are this position. You are the baseball player, right? You are the wrestler, right? When you're in high school, you tend to define yourself by that. Yes, I'm on the football team, right? Your social acceptance, every reward system in your life is built upon this title, right? So I'm going to go into it from an investigative standpoint, right? Not trying to say sports are bad, because I want to talk about there's a lot of good things that come out of it too. So it's about what we'll find on this journey of writing this next book of mine, Athlete's Depression. If you want to find any more articles and things I posted on it, just search the hashtag Athlete's Depression. You'll find a lot of things I posted about it as well. So I look forward to sitting down really hardcore beginning Monday and beginning to type on this book, Athlete's Depression. I got to get it out. Just like I got this podcast. Hope you've enjoyed this podcast, you all. It's an hour and 11 minutes, went a little far. But thank you, everyone, for tuning in live on Facebook. Go to the Cognitive Rampage. You can just type in Cognitive Rampage. You don't have to do the. But follow me on Facebook. Like the page there. Ask to see when we go live. You can watch these podcasts live on Facebook. Anytime I have a guest on the podcast, which is going to start to be a little more frequent than it has been over the last couple of days. I actually got an old friend of mine coming in on Monday to do a podcast. Mike the Messenger Williams will be here on Monday at noon to do a podcast. Always enjoy talking to Mike, man. He's a really, really interesting guy, a caring guy. Got an interesting story too, man. It's talk about, what's the word I'm looking for? I can't even think about it. I can't. I don't know. I'm at a loss. I've been doing this for an hour and a half. He is certainly a mind and a heart and a spirit worth listening to. So Mike will be here Monday, Mike the Messenger Williams, and then you'll start to see more athletes after that on the podcast. But anytime a guest is not in studio, Mike's going to be in studio, but anytime a guest is not in studio, you can watch live or later on our YouTube page, Cognitive Rampage on YouTube. Please subscribe to that too. You can go back. So if you see on Facebook where you may see where there's some number skipped where it's like podcast 2 whatever and then 231 and then all of a sudden 234, it's because we had a guest on, and that guest, you can catch every podcast on the YouTube channel as well as iTunes. Huge love and thank you to everybody that watches live on Facebook, likes that page, and has subscribed on YouTube, and a whole lot of huge and love to all of our subscribers on iTunes, on Stitcher as well for the Android users, and those overseas too. Thank you so much for listening to the Cognitive Rampage podcast when I ramble or whatever it is. And just thank you. Thank you very much. Please also go to iTunes, subscribe to the Cognitive Rampage there on iTunes, Stitcher for Android, or Podbean for everybody. Love you all very much. And I will see you Monday with Mike the Messenger Williams. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your Cognitive Rampage.
Call my name. bloodstain. Cause the devil's forever in my veins.
Forever in my veins.